Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs will come to order. First, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the passing of our friend and former colleague, Senator Mike Enzi. Some of us served with him on this committee, which he joined in 1997. We remember his kindness, his personal birthday notes that we all look forward to. He spoke at our Ohio College President's Conference each year. We always try to bring leaders in of both parties, sharing his insight about higher education with higher education leaders in my state. He talked often of bipartisanship, and he meant it. On a personal note, I think of our long discussions about Boy Scouts. We were both Eagle Scouts. We often talked about his life's work, really, in many ways, to strengthen the scouting movement. Our thoughts are with his wife, Diana, his children, Amy, Emily, and Brad, and with the people of Wyoming, a true public servant. Since Bitcoin came online in 2009, thousands of these so-called digital assets, virtual currencies, cryptocurrencies, stable coins, investment tokens have poured into the markets. All of these currencies have one thing in common. They're not real dollars. They're not backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. That means they all put Americans' hard-earned money at risk. From tech giants like Facebook's Libra or Diem or however their PR consultants attempt to rebrand it next to fly-by-night operations, we've seen far more empty promises than we've seen viable cryptocurrencies. A cottage industry of decentralized financial schemes has also cropped up alongside these alternative financial products in the hopes of creating a parallel financial system with no rules, no oversight, no limits. They claim to enable transparency. Their backers talk about the democratization of banking. There's nothing democratic or transparent about a shady, diffuse network of online funny money. After a decade of experience with these technologies, it seems safe to say that the vast majority haven't been good for anyone but their creators. This technology is almost never used to buy goods and services, which is what any currency is supposed to be used for, after all. Some cryptocurrency supporters see these technologies as a way to take power back from Wall Street bankers whose too often complicated and opaque financial scheming crashed the economy. When the only other option appears to be Wall Street, maybe it's hard to blame anyone for putting their faith in cryptocurrency. I hear the same message we all do over and over from people in our states that they don't trust banks. They especially don't trust the biggest banks. They've been burned over and over again by fees, by minimum balances, by waiting periods, by segregated second chance accounts. And of course, they all remember the crash, the bailouts, the lack of accountability. But as these technologies have developed, most of them seem to mirror rather than to challenge the Wall Street model. In fact, traditional financial institutions are angling to become the biggest players in these markets. It's a good bet they'll find even more creative ways to use these new technologies to dodge accountability and put our economy at risk. We should all be concerned. Thankfully, President Biden has begun to replace Trump-era financial appointees with real financial watchdogs who take seriously the job of protecting people's hard-earned money. But the financial recovery remains fragile as coronavirus variants emerge, and there are still regulators to appoint. Yet some of these underlying technologies may have useful applications beyond evasion of banking and security laws. These are generally applications outside of finance. One of these technologies we'll hear about today, Filecoin, uses economic incentives to provide digital storage space. But if we want a solution to America's legitimate fears and concerns and anger about our financial system, shady startups are not the answer. We need more community banks that are actually in people's neighborhoods and that understand their lives. We need no-fee accounts backed by the full faith and credit of the United States through the Federal Reserve that allow everyone to open a bank account and make online purchases. And we need to show people there will be accountability, not just a default to the same Wall Street system where bankers get all the profits and working families get all the risk. We need to make sure the American economy remains the safest and most dependable in the world. The last thing we should be doing is giving another industry a chance at wrecking that reputation, a reputation we've built for decades and our economy depends on. The best thing we can do to protect Americans' money is to adopt smart regulations that protect consumers, that protect investors, that separate the innovators from the extortionists. I look forward to hearing more today, learning more from our witnesses. Ranking Member Two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One sentiment that I certainly share with you were your kind remarks about our former colleague, Mike Enzi. I don't know if I've ever met a more good, decent, honorable man than Mike Enzi. We're going to miss him, and our hearts go out to his lovely wife, Diana. Today's hearing provides us an opportunity to learn about the current and potential uses of cryptocurrencies. In short, a cryptocurrency connects one person with another through an open public network separate from government control or any other intermediaries. And cryptocurrencies are a growing part of our economy. The first cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, was implemented in 2009. And while there are varying definitions of what is considered a cryptocurrency, there are now thousands of them available in many different forms. According to a recent University of Chicago survey, 13% of Americans bought or traded cryptocurrencies of some kind in the past 12 months. That's more than half the total percentage of Americans who invested in stocks during that same period of time. And like other currencies, cryptocurrencies may be useful as a store of value or a medium of exchange. However, it's important to acknowledge up front that a significant impediment to cryptocurrencies, or at least most cryptocurrencies, becoming a widely used store of value or medium of exchange is their price volatility. That problem could potentially be solved by tying a cryptocurrency to other assets, such as a fiat currency like the US dollar, for instance. And that's what stablecoins are meant to do. On the other hand, some cryptocurrencies may prove to be useful as a store of value by serving as alternatives to fiat currencies like the dollar. They may serve as a store of value because, unlike fiat currencies, the government can't come along and print trillions of a cryptocurrency. In this way, cryptocurrencies might complement the role that gold has historically played as a store of value and a hedge against inflation. For example, we've seen recently in Venezuela how people can use Bitcoin to store value when their government devalues their currency. Also, some cryptocurrencies may prove to be useful as a medium of exchange for buying goods and services. With cryptocurrencies, making payments and conducting transactions may become cheaper, easier, and faster for consumers than it is using traditional currencies. Cryptocurrencies can be exchanged without the need for an intermediary, such as a bank, which could virtually reduce transaction costs and fees for consumers to zero. In addition, since a person does not need a bank account to use cryptocurrencies, they could increase access to financial services for many Americans. Beyond these often discussed uses for cryptocurrencies, there are other ways that the distributed ledger technology that underlies crypto could be used, can be used. A distributed ledger is a database that shares information across various sites and geographies that's accessible by multiple people. This structure ensures that all these people can access and verify the data, and it dramatically reduces the risk of any one central actor manipulating the data. In my view, the use of distributed ledger technology to have non-intermediated transactions verified in a foolproof way is a very powerful technological innovation. And this innovation already is having an impact on supply chains, financial services, and securing digital identities. And I think it has significant potential for verifying the ownership of property, whether it might be automobiles or homes or securities. In the United States, we spend a lot of time and money to verify property ownership. Distributed ledger technology may provide a way to do this faster and at a lower cost. Over time, it's possible that the application of this innovation may become more important than the usefulness of crypto as a currency per se. And we're already seeing it have a real-world impact. As we all know, democracy and individual freedom in Hong Kong are under assault from the Chinese Communist Party. That assault has included the forced closure of a pro-democracy newspaper, Apple Daily. But the Chinese government has not been able to erase Apple Daily's important work. That's because Arweave, a cryptocurrency network that enables permanent data storage, was used to permanently store portions of the paper. This technology makes it impossible for the Chinese government to destroy Apple Daily's work, no matter how hard it tries. That's just one example. Today, we'll hear from two expert witnesses about other current and potential uses of cryptocurrencies. Mr. Jerry Brito is executive director of Coin Center, a think tank focused on cryptocurrencies and related topics. He will discuss an array of uses for cryptocurrencies and how these technologies could be further developed. Ms. Marta Belcher is chair of the Filecoin Foundation. She helped to develop and launch a cryptocurrency, Filecoin, that provides data storage access on a decentralized file storage network. Now, it's important to note that many people have raised legitimate issues about cryptocurrencies. These include their use in illicit activity and the possible effects on monetary policy and our existing financial infrastructure. I think we need to discuss and understand these issues and address them if we need to. But we shouldn't lose sight of the tremendous potential benefits that distributed ledger technology offers. We should also be mindful that private innovation has enabled most of these developments. Excuse me. We should not suppress the concepts of individual entrepreneurship and empowerment that have made this innovation possible. I look forward to hearing from our witnesses today about the ways cryptocurrencies are impacting and can potentially impact our lives, and I hope we'll all listen with open minds. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Toomey. Our witnesses today are Professor Angela Walsh, Professor of Law, St. Mary's University School of Law, Research Associate at the University College London Center for Blockchain Technologies. Welcome, Professor Walsh. Mr. Jerry Brito, Executive Director of Coin Center, a nonprofit research and advocacy organization focused on policy relating to cryptocurrencies and other distributed computing technologies. Welcome, Mr. Brito, and Ms. Marta Belcher, Chair of the Filecoin Foundation. She's also the General Counsel and Head of Policy at Protocol Labs, and she's counsel to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Welcome, Ms. Belcher. Professor Walsh, you are recognized for 5 minutes. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Chair Brown, Ranking Member Toomey, and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for inviting me to testify here today. My name is Angela Walsh. I am a professor of law at St. Mary's University School of Law in San Antonio, Texas, and a research associate at the Center for Blockchain Technologies at University College London. I have been researching cryptocurrencies since 2013 and have published numerous papers on the topic. My research has focused on the governance of crypto systems, the problematic use of language in the crypto space, and the ways that misunderstandings about these systems can contribute to systemic risk. I have a few key messages for the committee today. First, over the past several years, we have witnessed the creation of an alternative crypto financial system, with the growth of this financial system dramatically increasing over just the past year or two. Cryptocurrencies hit a market cap of over $2 trillion in April, and there has been rapid integration of digital assets into the traditional financial system through investments by large publicly traded companies and venture capital firms, the creation of crypto-based financial products, and the building of infrastructure to enable both retail and institutional investors to participate more seamlessly in the crypto ecosystem. Each of these actions creates links between the crypto financial system and the traditional financial system. Second, as the crypto financial system grows and more links are created between it and the traditional financial system, there is potential for crises in the crypto financial system to cross over to the traditional financial system, causing a systemic crisis. This could result in widespread harm to the public, both in the U.S. and globally, including to people who have not chosen to invest or otherwise participate in the crypto financial system. As a single example, imagine a critical software bug in a cryptocurrency like Ether, causing the Ethereum network to split in two, creating uncertainty and panic amongst Ether holders and the entire decentralized financial system that runs on the Ethereum network, known as DeFi. With enough links between the crypto financial system and the traditional financial system, such a crisis could ripple through those links to the traditional financial system, spreading the effects of this single software bug widely. Third, many of the decisions that we are making about the crypto financial system appear to be based on idealized views of crypto rather than realistic views. Another way to say this is that people and institutions may be investing in crypto's promise, and policymakers and regulators may be making decisions about how to treat the crypto financial system based on myths about crypto. Let me give you a few examples. You have probably heard that crypto systems like Bitcoin and Ethereum are transformational and positive for freedom because they are decentralized and have no intermediaries and therefore no intermediary risk. That they enable people to send value directly over the internet just like you might pay someone in cash, that they create immutable records that cannot be changed, that certain ones like Bitcoin have fixed caps on the number of units that can ever be created, that they are secure and tamper-proof, open and transparent so no bad behavior can be hidden, that they are protected and regulated internally by the incentives built into the systems, that concentrations of power that could be exploited don't exist or are sufficiently checked by the design of the system. If all of this were indisputably true, then yes, this does sound amazing and like something everyone should be participating in. But every single one of these characteristics of cryptocurrencies and digital assets that I have recited is only sort of true, as each requires an asterisk to indicate the many limitations on its accuracy. If you analyze these systems carefully, you realize that what are claimed to be characteristics of these systems are largely aspirations of these systems. Treating aspirations as reality means that every single decision based on the aspirations is flawed and embeds risk. If we believe that crypto systems have no intermediaries, for example, and make investment and regulatory decisions based on this fact, then the intermediaries that do exist can exploit their positions with impunity, as we are seeing with miners on the Ethereum network today. No one thinks the existing financial system is perfect. It is riddled with problems, corruption, concentration of power, exploitation, excessive risk-taking, and other human problems that Congress has long sought to contain and remedy through regulation. But crypto, understood through a realistic lens, is not a miracle get-out-of-the-financial-system-free card. It has the same problems. We need to acknowledge the power concentrations within it and make thoughtful policy and risk decisions about how to address that power. Thank you again for inviting me, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Professor Walsh. Mr. Brittos, you're recognized for 5 minutes. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chairman Brown, Ranking Member Toomey, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The title of this hearing is Cryptocurrencies, What Are They Good For? After a decade since Bitcoin's invention, what do we have to show for it? What justifies all the hype and investment? Is there today any tangible use case that is meaningfully improving people's lives? Those questions bring to mind the early days of another open, permissionless network, the internet. There was real skepticism that despite all the hype over the information superhighway, we still had very little to show for it, leading Paul Krugman to famously predict in 1998 that, quote, the growth of the internet will slow drastically because most people have nothing to say to each other. By 2005 or so, it will become clear that the internet's impact on the economy has been no greater than the fax machines, end quote. The fact that in 1998, there was no Wikipedia or Netflix or Zoom could lead one to believe that there never would be, and that the internet would continue to only be the domain of its earliest adopters, computer enthusiasts, spammers, gamblers, and pornographers. What skeptics missed is that an open and permissionless platform to which anyone could connect and on which anyone could build would allow an explosion of entrepreneurial innovation that would give us applications we could not imagine or predict. Cryptocurrency networks like Bitcoin are open and permissionless networks just the same. And while we may not yet have the Wikipedia or Netflix of cryptocurrency, that does not mean that we never will. And indeed, there are thousands of entrepreneurs around the world developing new applications of cryptocurrency networks, some of which I have no doubt will change the world, even if I can't now predict what they are. But even if we can't predict the future, what are some concrete applications that we can see today? First, there is the base application of Bitcoin, permissionless person-to-person payments. In the U.S., we take for granted that we can send each other funds effortlessly with our smartphones. But this is not the case everywhere in the world, especially where authoritarian governments block payments to and from dissidents. Just last year, pro-democracy labor activists in Belarus and anti-police violence protesters in Nigeria successfully turned to the Bitcoin network to accept donations because local banks would not bank them. Beyond payments and money, I would point to novel applications of cryptocurrencies, tamper-resistant ledgers. Chinese social media is heavily censored. This has led Chinese activists to post messages to the Ethereum blockchain where they cannot be taken down. There are many applications of cryptocurrency networks being developed for free speech that cannot be censored by authoritarian governments. Perhaps more relevant to average Americans are the potential applications of cryptocurrency and its tamper resistance to enable identity solutions for cybersecurity. The root cause of many data breaches, such as those of Experian, Equifax, or OPM, is the fact that if an attacker can compromise the password of one individual, he may gain access to the personal information of millions of others. Microsoft is a company that is painfully aware of this vulnerability, as it provides the identity infrastructure for over 90% of the Fortune 500 companies. This is why Microsoft spent years helping develop a decentralized identity standard built on top of Bitcoin. It is called the Ion Network. It was launched in March. It is live and operational and is now a candidate web standard. By replacing usernames and passwords with decentralized identifiers, the Ion Network will allow individuals to control their own identities rather than trust data brokers that can be compromised at root. This means that an attacker would no longer be able to compromise just one credential in order to gain access to everyone else's, but would instead have to hack each individual, a massive improvement to cybersecurity. Other benefits of decentralized identifiers include the ability to verify credentials, helping, for example, to combat disinformation. With Ion, it will be trivially easy to verify that a photo that you're looking at was signed as authentic by its photographer, who in turn is credentialed by the Associated Press. Additionally, because you own your own identity and network of relationships to other identities, we will be able to see the emergence of an open, portable social graph that would allow for competition with incumbent social media networks. All of this requires Bitcoin to work. Like the early internet, the real lives, the real live use cases of cryptocurrency networks today, but we can only see glimpses of the truly world-changing applications to come. The Clinton administration successfully pursued a deliberate policy of avoiding undue restrictions of the internet. To reap the benefits of cryptocurrency networks, I hope we have the wisdom to do the same today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brito. Ms. Belcher, thank you for joining us. You're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman Brown, Ranking Member Toomey, and committee members for inviting me to testify today. I'm Marta Belcher. I serve as the chair of the Filecoin Foundation, one of many companies working on a cryptocurrency called Filecoin. The question posed by the hearing today is, what are cryptocurrencies good for? Our answer to that question is that cryptocurrency can be the foundation for a better internet, an alternative to big tech that puts people in control of their own data, protects user privacy and security, and permanently preserves humanity's most important information. Today, I would like to explain how. Cryptocurrency makes it possible to send monetary value across the globe instantly and securely, just as easily as you can send information over the internet by attaching a file to an email. That is to say, cryptocurrency does for monetary value what the internet did for information. For me, the most important thing about cryptocurrency is that it creates the ability to program money. In other words, you can write computer code that automatically transfers value upon a condition being met. For example, you could write a computer program that says, for every second of a song that I play, automatically transfer the equivalent of a millionth of a cent from me to the songwriter. This can happen instantly and automatically with no intermediary in between us, even across borders. This kind of transaction would be untenable using traditional payment systems. The cryptocurrency technology I work on, Filecoin, uses that same programmable money concept to create a decentralized file storage network. If you have extra storage space on your computer hardware, you can rent it out to others who will pay you to store their files or pieces of their files so that only the file owner can put the pieces back together. A computer program will regularly check that the files are still being stored on your computer, and if so, will automatically compensate you with cryptocurrency. It's like Airbnb for file storage. Storage providers rent out their extra storage space to earn Filecoin, and users spend Filecoin to store their files on other people's computers. Now, that may sound like a niche use case, but we believe that this could be a foundational technology for the next generation of the internet. Today's internet is centralized. The vast majority of data making up the many websites Americans use every day sit in warehouses owned by just three companies: Amazon Web Services, Microsoft, and Google Cloud. We've repeatedly seen these companies suffer blackouts and vast swaths of the web go down for hours, including websites that are massive contributors to the American economy. That's the problem with having single points of failure. We believe you can create a better version of the web if you combine the storage capacity and computing power on all of our individual devices into a supercomputer-like network and store multiple copies of data across those devices. On this decentralized version of the internet, websites will stay up even if some nodes fail, and the availability of information is not dependent on any one server or company. This provides a more robust platform for humanity's most important information. Filecoin provides the incentive for people to contribute storage to that decentralized internet. And these incentives work. Since launching last October, nearly 3,000 Filecoin storage providers have contributed nearly 8 exabytes of storage capacity. To put that in perspective, that could store all of the written works of mankind in all languages from the beginning of recorded history to today, 10 times over. And that storage space is being used to preserve humanity's most important information. As just one example, the Starling Lab, a project of Stanford and USC, uses the Filecoin network to permanently preserve the USC Shoah Foundation's archive of 55,000 video testimonies of genocide survivors. Filecoin is just one use of cryptocurrency, but it demonstrates how being able to program money to instantly, automatically send microtransactions across the world can create economic incentives that enable entirely new tech. There are already thousands of projects building other cryptocurrency applications, from automatically paying music royalties, to compensating people when their data is used, to paying journalists for each view of an article, to incentivizing consumers to use renewable energy. Some may not succeed, but others may move technology forward in ways we cannot yet begin to imagine. This technology is in its early days, and the stage of development for cryptocurrency is often compared to the internet of the early 90s. It would have been a mistake in 1995 to believe that we understood then what the internet was good for. I would urge the committee to embrace the possibility that cryptocurrency's uses might be just as expansive and to ensure that innovation in this space can continue to thrive. I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Belcher. Professor Walsh, start with a couple questions. You proponents of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or Ether use the word decentralized. We've all heard that word in the testimony to make it appear as though these companies are people with outsized, to make it appear that there are not companies with outsized power over these financial systems. They claim that decentralization puts users on equal footing and reduces inequality. We now know that Wall Street mega banks and hedge funds have a stranglehold, of course, over the financial system. Are there similar actors who could get outsized power in crypto markets?
Absolutely. Yes, I think the term decentralized can really be misleading to us. If we stop at the label of decentralized because this is just crypto and that's the way it is, then we miss looking into these systems and seeing the concentrated pockets of power within them. And parties who sit in those pockets of power include the core software developers that create these systems, maintain them, are responsible for continuing to help them operate if a critical bug is discovered, making decisions about what policies are implemented into the software code that comprises the system. We've seen this again and again when there have been critical bugs identified in crypto systems and the 4 or 5 software developers have to make a decision about how to handle it for the multi-billion dollar system. We also see miners in these systems having concentrations of power.
So explore a little bit more the term decentralized. Have there been instances where powerful companies or individuals have been able to bend the rules, claiming decentralization, but bend the rules to benefit themselves?
So we see miners in systems like Ethereum and Bitcoin, the ones that use the proof of work consensus mechanism, being able to exploit their position. So there are very large mining pools. And what is significant about miners is that they have a power that has not been very well understood. And that is they get to pick the transactions that are in the memory pool and decide whether a transaction goes in there, what order it goes in on this powerful ledger, and they are able to accept bribes. You can call them bribes. You can just call them payments to exploit that ordering power, taking money for themselves, potentially. It's called miner extractable value. And I hope that we will be able to discuss it further because it's seen as a potentially killer for the idea of cryptocurrencies.
This sounds to me like something we see in this committee on a number of different issues, sort of a phony populist marketing brought to us by people that have immense power in the marketplace one way or the other. Let me ask you one more question, Professor. As you said in your testimony, crypto economic systems are beginning to mirror the functions of the traditional financial system. Talk about risk to financial stability from having a separate financial system operating parallel to the traditional financial system. You talked in your testimony about sort of migrating into the traditional system. What might those delineate those risks, if you would?
Sure. So when we have two systems sitting beside each other, one crypto financial system and one traditional financial system, and one, the traditional financial system being regulated while the crypto one is not, we can see through these links that are being built, such as investments in cryptocurrencies by large players in the traditional financial system, like MicroStrategy, like Tesla, who are always in the news these days, with the significant institutional investments, with the crypto investment products, hedge funds, venture capital funds, et cetera. Many, many links are being formed so that things that go wrong in the crypto system, a catastrophic software bug, any sort of failure there can actually have an impact on every single holder of the cryptocurrency that is affected, all the holders of financial products that embed that cryptocurrency, all the investment funds that touch that cryptocurrency, all the potential other cryptocurrencies within the crypto financial system because of the fear of contagion, and that can easily ripple over to the financial system. I'm not claiming that that can happen today, but with every link that is built and the larger the crypto financial system grows, that risk increases.
Thank you. Senator Lummis is recognized for 5 minutes from Wyoming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member, for allowing me to go ahead so I can go to the floor and pay a little tribute to my dear friend Mike Enzi that you both served with and so many of you served with, who passed away today. And I am deeply grateful for this opportunity. So thank you. Professor Walsh, you mentioned in your written testimony that there are no definitively established definitions in the digital asset space. And I think you hit the nail on the head there. If we can have a law textbook like this one on virtual currency, we should be able to agree on common terms. So why is it so important that Congress and our regulators begin to use the same legal terms to talk about these issues?
Sure. So I've thought a lot about this, and it's been an important part of my research. I think that these problems with terminology come from the fact that these systems are extremely fast moving, that there are products and activities in the created in the crypto financial system that kind of mirror the financial systems, but we don't know what to call them. Do you call them the same thing? How are they different? Right. So there's a ton of confusion, and we have seen this already reflected in laws that have been passed in a bunch of state legislatures about cryptocurrencies, crypto systems, where misunderstandings and improper terminology is embedded into the definitions of these in the laws that are meant to, you know, support or enable innovation with cryptocurrencies. And I wish there was an easy solution to this problem. We've been talking about it for years, and the language, people keep adding new terms like miner extractable value and yield farming and a whole bunch of things that everyone has to learn anew when they come into the system. So it's a persistent problem and can have important impacts.
Well, thank you, Professor. And I do think that that's a point where Congress can weigh in. So I'm looking forward to working on that through our Financial Innovation Caucus and perhaps bringing something forward definition-wise for us all to consider. Is it Brito or Brito? Well, it's lovely to have you here. Thank you so much. Can you give me some specific use cases on how virtual currency and the distributed ledger technology that underpins these assets has the potential to reduce the cost of financial transactions for everyone and to create a more efficient financial system?
Sure. Thank you for the question. There are any number of use cases where some function that today is happening in a financial system through that depends on a centralized intermediary could be done potentially more efficiently if the two parties who rely on that intermediary can connect you know, one-on-one. And, you know, one example that simply comes to mind would be settlement and finality, right? So today, when you want to trade securities or other assets, you ultimately rely on a series of intermediaries that ultimately have one settlement intermediary where there's a book that is, you know, sort of updated by that one party. You can imagine a system that depends on one global ledger that anybody has access to and can swap. You know, Senator Toomey mentioned property registries is a potential there. So today in the United States, we have title insurance. Why do we have title insurance? Well, we have title insurance because the chain of title to a piece of property might have been corrupted somewhere along the way. With cryptographic distributed ledgers, the potential for that is greatly, greatly reduced. And so, for example, you might be able to eliminate the need for that kind of insurance.
Well, that's helpful and informative, because I would note that the St. Louis Fed has noted that the U.S. financial sector cost 8.2% of GDP in 2021, and that payments cost around 1% of GDP. Additionally, billions of dollars in capital is trapped every day because of antiquated means of payment that take days or even weeks to settle. For a Fortune 500 company that regularly sends international wire transfers, this is costly. And it's a very big deal, and it's something that we also might be able to take advantage of by some of these new distributed ledger technologies. Mr. Brito, we hear a lot, both true and false, about how our existing financial system benefits some groups more than others. Isn't the transparency and openness of open source finance a huge benefit that can ensure a level playing field, promote financial inclusion, and create trust in our financial system?
So I fear overpromising when it comes to saying that something like Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies like it will guarantee financial inclusion for everybody. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. But what I can say is that because these systems are broadly transparent, you can see where there is, where the power centers may be, and you can go and address them, and you can see what the transactions are. And that is a great improvement. And to the extent that you can have parties interacting with each other and doing so transparently, that would reduce the need for trust, as you say.
Well, and one of the points you raised also sort of segues into my next question, and that's about virtual currencies and money laundering. There's a myth that virtual currency is anonymous. But aren't most virtual currency transactions recorded on a publicly available ledger that cannot be easily altered? It seems to me any criminal would avoid creating evidence like that.
Yes, the vast majority of transactions using cryptocurrency are recorded transparently on an open ledger, and these are available to law enforcement. And indeed, talking to law enforcement, they tell us how useful that evidence is. So why do criminals continue to use these networks? Well, because it's Bitcoin and things like it are good for payments, are good for censorship-resistant payments. And so they abuse these networks. But you're right, they create a trail that, with the help of on-ramps and off-ramps that are regulated and compliant, can help law enforcement find and prosecute these criminals.
I thank their witnesses today for their very helpful testimony. And, Mr. Chairman, I yield back with my thanks.
Thank you, Senator Leavitt. Senator Reed of Rhode Island is recognized.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Let me begin by recognizing the passing of Mike Enzi. Mike and I came to the Senate in 1997 and to this committee in 1997. Mm-hmm. And he was a paragon of integrity and decency that we all looked up to. And his passing is deeply grieved by all of us. So with that, let me direct a question to Ms. Walsh. Chairman Brown talked about the intermediaries as not simply a neutral sort of technical aspect, but they have a position which they could exploit in this system. And at this point, we have no way to confirm who these people are. Is that correct?
So I'm interpreting your question to be asking about who the intermediaries are within the systems, right? Who the middlemen are between one person sending a crypto token to another person. And that is the miners, right? A transaction doesn't end up on the blockchain unless a miner puts it on there. Okay, so they have not yet been recognized. We still, as intermediaries, right? People still call these systems disintermediated. And the power that they exercise is in choosing the transactions, ordering them, and they can delay people's transactions. They can take money to do what are called things like sandwich attacks and front running and back running and all kinds of games. And there has not been very good research into the mining or validating community. They're coming out of the shadows much more. Many of them have migrated just recently from China, where they were highly concentrated, and China recently made it illegal for miners to Bitcoin miners to operate there. So many are coming to the U.S., many to my home state of Texas. And I think these players need more scrutiny. They are intermediaries in important multi-million dollar, multi-billion dollar financial systems. They need more scrutiny.
And your question raises another question I have is, China is taking a very close look at this whole operation, as indicated by their dispersion of the miners in China. What's their goal? Do they want to set up an alternate system? Do they want to be able to influence this system so that at a critical moment they can cause disruption?
So, I wish I could tell you what China's goal is.
I wish I could tell you.
But,
awesome.
I think that there is speculation that China and other nations feel threatened by cryptocurrencies, right? Because they are alternative, non-sovereign monetary systems and financial systems and are not easily controllable by governments or regulated by governments. I mean, over the past 10 years, that's been the case. I think that China also is looking into very strongly issuing a central bank digital currency right now, and may feel that the threat from cryptocurrencies is more than they want to deal with, and certainly not that they want to support as much as they were within their own borders.
One of the other aspects, of course, and I think everyone's alluded to it, is one of the mainstays of our economic policy is macroeconomic policy. The Federal Reserve's control in the United States and the European Union system of the value of currency, and that could be compromised by either intentionally or unintentionally by cryptocurrencies. Is that accurate?
So, I mean, one of the original motivations of cryptocurrencies was creating an alternate financial system, an alternate monetary system. And that was due to a lack of faith, really, in existing monetary systems and a feeling that governments were not very responsible stewards of the money that they issued. I think there is a fundamental tension between the existence of cryptocurrencies and sovereign currencies. We're seeing that play out in very strange ways right now. I think we're in the midst of kind of a revolution on and significant change on what money is and who gets to make it, right? We're seeing that with events like El Salvador adopting Bitcoin as legal tender, right? We're seeing this with the race of central bank digital of countries to consider whether they should issue central bank digital currencies, I think in part to compete with cryptocurrencies. And I think that given what we've seen over the past few years with the loss of faith in institutions, which is like literally across the board, right, that cryptocurrencies are seen as kind of like a safety valve for collapse of important systems. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on here.
Just a comment. The most incisive comment I ever heard about new disruptive technologies, it makes bad things, it makes good things better and bad things worse.
Okay.
And I think that's where we are. And that's the role of government, to make sure the good things are preserved and the bad things are avoided. And I think the comparison between the internet is interesting because, from my perspective, they've displaced newspapers, responsible reporting on TV, et cetera. We're into a world of disinformation, which is complicating our lives. Just look at the vaccination issues. And disinformation, it seems to be the coin of the realm now, not facts. So I think we have to be very, very careful going forward and not learn from our internet experience and think carefully about judicious ways we can provide controls. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Reid. Senator Toomey is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brito, Ms. Walsh, in her testimony, suggests, I think it's fair to say, that it's problematic to think of some of the attributes that we often associate with cryptocurrencies in absolute terms, and that they are rather relative terms. She's got a list, the idea that it's immutable, decentralized, trustless, secure, tamper-proof, disintermediated, and several others. How do you think about this question of whether these concepts are absolute or relative, and how much does that matter?
Sure. Thank you for the question. I think in any complicated system, you really can't think in terms of absolute. When you're having conversations, perhaps even on Twitter, where a lot of these conversations happen, I think there's a shorthand to talk, in a shorthand sort of way and talk in absolutes. But I think anybody serious discussing this isn't talking in terms of absolutes. And indeed, that's certainly the case. I think it goes a little bit far to say then that this is confusing policymakers and regulators and people who need to pay attention to that, right? So if you listen to Chairman Brown's statement, clearly people are paying attention to the wiggle room here and are addressing it.
Just to follow up on this, Ms. Walsh also expressed the concern about problems that could emerge, bugs that could be discovered. In fact, there have been bugs discovered in cryptocurrencies. And she posited a hypothetical about, a problem being discovered, say, in Ethereum that caused a loss of confidence that cascaded into the financial system. How concerned should we be about a problem developing in a cryptocurrency cascading into the conventional financial system?
So, I don't think it's an impossibility. It's possible. I will say two things about it. First is, what is the systemic risk that exists with crypto today? And I'm not an expert in systemic risk, so I look to the experts. And, recently the Atlanta Fed president, Rafael Bostic, said that there's a lot of volatility, but right now it's not at a scale and it doesn't reach into the economy in a way that has systematic implications for us. That was it has been echoed by St. Louis Fed President James Bullard, by the European Central Bank, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not there. Something to keep an eye on, absolutely, and to make sure that these links that Professor Walsh refers to are supervised and regulated, et cetera. The other thing I would say briefly is a lot of what Professor Walsh just said in her testimony just now is that you can have a lot of hedge funds and other investment vehicles invest in cryptocurrencies that then later, if there's a bug, could decrease in value and have a systemic risk. The thing could be said for any commodity, right? Cryptocurrencies ultimately are commodities. You can imagine an investment in orange juice, and you can imagine a literal bug that wipes out the orange crop could have a systematic effect. So it's certainly a possibility, but I wouldn't say that it's something that would that should lead us to shy away from cryptocurrencies, just to make sure that we have the right guardrails in place for hedge funds and other investment vehicles.
We've had a little discussion about miners, and miners play an essential role in validating transactions and maintaining the infrastructure. Should they be thought of as intermediaries or as people taking a bribe in return for doing the validation?
Yeah, so I don't think it's controversial to say that miners are technically, in some broad sense, intermediaries. But I don't think they're intermediaries in the way that this committee thinks about it, right? They're not financial intermediaries for financial regulation. So, for example, when I send you money using PayPal online, PayPal is clearly an intermediary, right? They're a financial intermediary that can block my transaction, not allow me to make a payment at all, can lose my money, they're a custodian, et cetera. So they're a financial intermediary, which is what we care about. But there's another intermediary in this transaction that I'm making with you, and that is my ISP, my internet service provider, right? I need my ISP as an intermediary to be able to use PayPal to pay you. But we don't think of ISPs as intermediaries. And indeed, in money transmission laws in the various states, that basically regulate the facilitation of the transmission of money explicitly exclude ISPs and other service providers from regulation. And indeed, the New York Department of Financial Services in their BIT license excludes minors because they don't think about them as these kinds of intermediaries.
That's very helpful. One last question, and this is from Ms. Belcher. You discussed a fascinating actual real world use case that is not about speculating on the value of the currency, but rather accessing decentralized storage. So my question for you is, can you explain why cryptocurrency is necessary in order to deliver that service?
Thank you for that question, Senator. Yes. So cryptocurrency creates the incentive for people to contribute their resources to maintain the network. And in this case, to contribute file storage. And that same code that enables you to transfer money, to transfer value instantly across the internet without an intermediary, also does the process of verifying that you are, in fact, storing files.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Menendez of New Jersey is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As cryptocurrencies become more commonplace, we can all agree that we'll begin to see more widespread adoption of crypto as a form of payment in physical retail outlets. So I'd like to ask each of you one basic question. Do you believe that a brick-and-mortar retail business, like a grocery store or a pharmacy, should be allowed to accept only cryptocurrency and deny customers the opportunity to pay with cash?
Thank you for the question, Senator. Speaking for Filecoin, Filecoin is not intended to be a competitor to the U.S. dollar, but rather to be used for a specific purpose of file storage. As I discussed in my testimony, cryptocurrencies have many uses beyond merely facilitating financial transactions. And I think that there are many cryptocurrencies that you can think of more like other commodities like gold that serve the same function without necessarily being a competitor to the U.S. dollar.
Yeah. My question is rather simple. A yes or no would suffice, but I will take yours as saying no.
Is that correct? The answer is no.
Yes.
Yeah. So today I could open up a store and accept only euros if I have that quirk. And I think the same should be for cryptocurrency. It's, you know, it's my store. It's a basic freedom.
Mm-hmm. Professor?
So I have a hard time. I'm a strong defender of cash. for many reasons. So it troubles me, given that not everybody has access to digital financial services, that they wouldn't be able to use cash in right. in basic retail stores.
Well, I agree with those of you who don't think it should be limited. You know, according to a May 2020 report by the Federal Reserve, over 1 in 5 Americans are unbanked or underbanked. And despite the potential, I don't think it's reasonable to expect that this segment of the population is going to suddenly jump into using cryptocurrency when they don't even have an opportunity to participate in the formal banking system. So we need to preserve the option of choice in how you pay for retail transactions. That's why I'm introducing the Payment Choice Act with Senator Cramer and others to make sure that Americans continue to have the option of paying cash for everyday purchases. And so millions of unbanked American households aren't shut out of the economy. Let me turn to another issue, which I follow very much as the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. That's sanction evasion. I've been actively following Venezuela, Russia, and other countries' interest in developing virtual currency for the explicit purpose of evading U.S. sanctions, as well as the broader pattern of cyber criminals demanding payments in cryptocurrency from their victims. And we're increasingly seeing a confluence between these two trends. The data firm Chainalysis estimates that out of all the ransomware payments made in 2020, 15% of them carried a risk of sanctions violations. So essentially, victims of ransomware attacks are increasingly finding themselves targeted by sanctioned entities, and therefore victims that make ransom payments in cryptocurrency may be committing sanctions violations. So how should we in Congress think about addressing this problem without undermining the efficacy of our sanctions tools?
So I'll take that question, Senator. So for years, the FBI has been advising the victims of ransomware not pay ransom demands. And this applies to any ransom demand. And if demand is coming from a sanctioned party, then it's not just advice. You can't pay the ransom. And on, the same advisory page on their website, the FBI highlights that the way to deal with ransomware is to A, have a good cybersecurity system to try to prevent the attack, and B, regularly backup data and secure those backups so you can confidently refuse to pay a ransom if it comes to that.
I would just add one point. I think part of our vulnerabilities to ransomware that we're seeing have developed over the years with, lax cybersecurity practices. And this may be tied in part to the liability framework that we've had around software development, which is that pretty much there's no liability even if your software is terrible and has lots of bugs, and all the any obligation to make good software is fully disclaimed in the software license. So I'm not saying that anyone can make perfect software, but the accountability paradigm may need to be rethought.
Well, I'm all for preventing the possibility of a ransomware attack, but I'm not for sacrificing our sanctions ability for the essence of protecting ransomware victims. One final question. According to the Cambridge Bitcoin Electricity Consumption Index, 4.6% of all Bitcoin mining occurs in Iran, making it the fifth largest miner in the world. Because the main cost associated with mining cryptocurrency is energy, Iran is effectively able to convert its oil and natural gas reserves into cash via cryptocurrency mining. Are there tools that would allow financial institutions and regulators to prevent the use of mining to avoid sanctions?
So, Senator, while there's nothing that can prevent anyone from with the right equipment and an internet connection from mining, what's interesting to me about this is that Iran is turning one commodity, oil, into another commodity, not into cash, really, but into another commodity, Bitcoin, let's say. And so it still has to find a way to trade it for hard currency, which is ultimately what it wants. And so, again, that's why it's so important that we have on-ramps and off-ramps that are regulated and compliant. And I can say that in the U.S., we have great anti-money laundering regulation that requires cryptocurrency exchanges to know their customers, to track all transactions, to collaborate with law enforcement, and they do. But overseas, there are exchanges that do not comply with U.S. regulation. And I think if you ask law enforcement, they will tell you that is the biggest challenge for them vis-a-vis sanctions violators and other criminals.
Now, they don't have to convert it into cash. They can use it for payment of necessary goods, and that's equally of value to them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Warner is recognized for 5 minutes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the fact that you and the ranking member are holding this hearing. I mean, Senator Menendez has talked about how a lot of these issues bleed into the Foreign Relations Committee. I can tell you from the Intel standpoint, we've had a number of hearings and discussions on this subject. I think it is how we approach this on a macro basis. I'm not 100% sure. I want to, and I can assure you on the ransomware piece, there is an awful lot of this being paid out and crypto being used as the payment methodology of choice. And I think if Americans knew how much was paid out on a daily, weekly basis, particularly in Bitcoin, people would be astonished. I want to take my direction of questions a little bit differently because, crypto writ large comes out of the whole fintech world. We know the fintech world has been basically unregulated. But Mr. Chairman, I'm seeing, particularly China start to China, Singapore, I think even Bermuda is ahead of us in terms of using blockchain to create a central bank digital currency. My fear is that in many ways, China, which is much further ahead of us on mobile payment systems, on Alipay and WeChat Pay, that these mobile payment systems, which are becoming prevalent, especially in Europe, that they then use as the default, if you've got a mobile payment, the digital you want. And we could wake up not dissimilar to where we woke up in 5G, where suddenly when we get alert to this problem, there is already kind of a global answer in place. And we've been a little bit asleep at the switch. Our central bank has been moving slower on this, but this is a very, very aggressive area that China's moving on. And again, using the mobile payment systems as the kind of camel's nose under the tent. So I'd like to hear from the whole panel, starting maybe with you, Gresham Walsh. How do we think about, and is there an appropriate forum to set some international standards, not only on, you know, digital currencies, but just across this whole field? Because my fear is, as your colleague pointed out, you know, we've got fairly decent anti-money laundering laws because, again, the work of this committee last year, a lot of the foreign entities don't. But let's stick with, you know, cryptocurrencies writ large and the and digital currencies backed by central banks as a start off point. Mm-hmm. Love to have the whole panel respond.
Great. So I agree with you that as these crypto systems are inherently global and international, that if there is sort of some regulation surrounding them, it will be difficult if it's just one country taking the lead on that. If it's just the U.S., right, then you risk everyone leaving the U.S. and doing things in other countries that don't have such strict regulatory systems. I think with a framework of something like FATF, right, that sets standards for anti-money laundering that it expects countries to adopt, you could imagine some sort of similar global organization that deals with cryptocurrencies and come to consensus about at least what are some of the core things.
But as you said, you could imagine it's not like there's anything out there real time.
Not that I'm aware of that is ongoing. I mean, certainly global bodies like the G20 are always discussing this. The Bank for International Settlements facilitates discussions of this. But I think it would be helpful if there were, you know, a more formal agreements about it.
Your colleagues have any other members of the panel?
Sure. So I'll just say two things. So, you know, we're focused on cryptocurrency. So we only tangentially look at central bank digital currency. But what I will say is two things. One, I would recommend that you look at an article by Henry Paulson in Foreign Affairs. I think it was earlier this year, maybe last year, where he addressed the question of a Chinese central bank digital currency. And his point, which I took to be persuasive, is that ultimately, while they may be digitizing the yuan, the currency is ultimately the yuan. And this is not an attractive currency that people want to hold. And so maybe, you know, it's not really something that threatens the supremacy of the dollar. Second thing I would say is, so then why is China doing this? I think the main reason that they are doing this is that they do not want to lose control over their own monetary sovereignty. Because I think their concern is that they're going to get dollarized, not that they're trying to yuanize us. They have strict capital controls, as you know, and I think they also want to have strict surveillance of what their population is doing. In Western China, for example, if you stop purchasing alcohol and tobacco, the police will come and check up on you. And they do this because they're looking at your transactions.
Can I hear your final point? And I know we're...
I would echo that I think it's important that a digital dollar implements measures to protect privacy, looking at China and the concerns that have been raised around CBDCs and surveillance.
I just tell you, Mr. Chairman, I think CBDCs, it's coming. If China ends up with the default mobile payment system being kind of the underlying payments for most mobile payments, and it's already happening in Europe and it's increasingly happening in Africa, and then the default currency becomes the digital yuan, I think the panel is underestimating, dramatically underestimating the potential threat that poses in terms of China's overall plan of technology dominance and the potential. And I frankly disagree with former Secretary Paulson on the intent that China brings to this. And I hope, again, that we can spend more time on it. And I appreciate both you and the ranking member having this hearing.
Thanks, Senator Waters. Senator Daines from Montana is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thanks again to all the witnesses for being here today. I truly believe we should always, we being the United States, should look to support innovation and be very careful that we don't ever regulate it out of existence. A light touch, I think, is what's called in this situation. Right now, Technologies is a company I worked for after I left Procter & Gamble. I was there for 12 years. So we were a pioneer in cloud computing. In fact, when I joined the company, we used to call it hosted company and non-hosted companies or on-premise. We were an open source Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP kind of run and gun startup. And we got a lot of traction, became the cloud. We were selling a CRM solution. Eventually, it was acquired by Oracle. But I've seen what it is to be on the leading edge of something and then turn to something very exciting. People thought we were crazy back then. And now, of course, the cloud is a massive industry. Filecoin, which is represented here by Ms. Belcher, provides data storage and access to on a decentralized file network and seeks to compete with AWS. This is just one of the many promising uses for cryptocurrencies. And the last thing we should do is regulate these innovators into oblivion. The innovations occurring in this space is creating high-paying jobs in many places, including my home state of Montana, because what we found is some of the brightest people want to live in the best places, and they like the ability to ski, backpack, fish, enjoy our national parks, and they're literally right out their back doors. And yet they're involved in some of the leading edge innovation type tech companies in the world. I think that's generally a very positive thing. Ms. Belcher, in your testimony, you described Filecoin as Airbnb for file storage. What type of growth are you expecting for Filecoin in the next 5 years?
Well, it's truly been a massive amount of growth just from October when we launched to present. I mentioned that the amount of storage we have right now is truly incredible, and we really hope to see that storage continue to grow as we've seen it growing, and we hope to continue to see it storing humanity's most important information and storing extremely important data sets that need to be preserved for posterity.
Thank you, Ms. Belcher. Mr. Brito, do you see any cryptocurrencies as potentially disrupting the SWIFT global payments network, and could they coexist?
So, no, I don't think there is going to be a disruption anytime imminently, right? So SWIFT is what allows for a transfer of dollars, and dollars make up, I mean, the overwhelming amount of the finance in the world. I do think that they can coexist. You can have both. And quite frankly, cryptocurrencies is not just about moving money. Cryptocurrency, you know, it has the word currency in it because that's what early pioneers of the technology was a word that they used. But really, these are open networks for verifying distributed ledgers. And what this means is that you're going to have cryptocurrency networks like Filecoin that store files. That has nothing to do with SWIFT, so they can definitely coexist.
Thank you. Ms. Belcher, unlike the private sector, Congress isn't fast, not real good at innovating. I think our founding fathers, by design, ensured that this city couldn't move real fast and wanted to keep it limited and to ensure that the private sector innovation and freedom would result in really the greatness of this country, which I believe it has. How could knee-jerk or overregulation hurt innovation in the jobs you're creating?
Well, I think that it is a myth to say that the cryptocurrency space is not regulated, and I think that as it exists today, there are many ways of effectively, sensibly applying existing regulations in the cryptocurrency space without needing to add any additional laws that potentially apply specifically to cryptocurrency and might regulate them in a different way. So, just as one example, some people raise issues around cryptocurrency, potential fraud in the space, but there's all sorts of different ways that you can have the CFPB or the FTC go after that kind of fraud. And it doesn't matter whether you are committing that fraud with cryptocurrency or pen and paper or the phone. And that's just to say that I think that existing regulations do a great job of ensuring the space is regulated without over-regulating cryptocurrency specifically.
One last quick question for Mr. Brito, and then we'll need a quick answer. I'm into extra innings here. You previously stated that you don't believe China's development of a digital yuan is a threat to the dollar. Could you briefly explain why you feel that way?
Sure, because ultimately, digital yuan is just digitization of the yuan. And the yuan has all the problems that economists can point out. Most recently, when the COVID pandemic hit, we saw a flight to safety. Did money move to the yuan, or did it move massively to the dollar? It came to the dollar.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Peter. Thanks for the short answer, too. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Senator Dean. Senator Tester from Montana is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to echo the comments of previous folks who have asked questions. I appreciate you and the ranking member having this hearing. Before I start on the questions, I just want to say that the word decency and Mike Enzi go hand in hand. And Mike was a fine man who treated everybody with respect and somebody that obviously is not already missed around here, but somebody who will be missed by not only us, but by the state of Wyoming. Quality people are not easily replaced. And our thoughts are with Diana and the rest of the Enzi family and the people of Wyoming. I want to start by talking about some people here have talked about this being a regulated market or there's regulation within the market. I don't see a lot of regulation in this market. And my question for all three of you, and as briefly as you can, because we can burn 4 minutes on this really quickly, as briefly as you can, do you think this should be a regulated market in a way that's similar to our conventional monetary system? Ms. Walsh?
So I have gone back and forth on this for many years. And what's finally crystallized for me is that I think that the crypto financial system is different enough from the existing financial system that we need to think carefully about tailoring actual rules that might apply for it. I think that during the last 10 years, there's been a lot of time spent debating about how crypto fits into our very complex existing financial regulatory scheme.
Okay. Yep. Go ahead, Mr. Brito.
So in the United States, we don't regulate technologies. We regulate activities.
Okay.
So to the extent that there are activities that pose a risk the same way that they do in traditional financial markets, absolutely those risks, those activities should be.
Ms. Belcher?
I think regulations already are being applied in this space. Just as one example, cryptocurrency on-ramps and off-ramps are heavily regulated. They do KYC, they register with FinCEN, they cooperate with law enforcement, there's report suspicious activities. So I do think that there are regulations that are being applied to this space, even though they're not crypto-specific.
So I'll stay with you, Ms. Belcher. So when we have a situation where we have cyber criminals that ask for money on a essential piece of property like the Colonial Pipeline that is critical infrastructure for this country. And one of my constituents turns on the TV and sees that the payment was made in cryptocurrency. What should that person be thinking?
I think that ransomware is not a cryptocurrency problem. I think it's a cybersecurity problem. And I think where we saw in the Colonial...
Time out here for a second. Okay, so... if you've got a ransom that's being required and it's paid for in cryptocurrency, and albeit some of that cryptocurrency or maybe all of it was gotten back, I'm not sure I've heard the entire story. Cryptocurrency can't wash their hands and say, well, this isn't really my problem. It's somebody else's problem. No, it's like it or not, it's a problem. And cryptocurrency is a part of that problem.
I think many crimes have also been committed with cash. And I think that in terms of crimes committed with cryptocurrency, we were actually able to get the Colonial Pipeline ransom back because cryptocurrency is actually a public.
And do you think that's going to be the way it is in all cases? Because this is going to continue. And by the way, on China's standpoint, I'll just tell you this. I think that if we think they're getting rid of the miners because they don't like them, if they didn't like them, they'd treat them like they treat the Uyghurs. They're shipping them around the world because they know these guys can raise hell with our financial system. That's my opinion. And they want to be able to be the big player in the financial industry. But the real question here is that if in fact we've got bad actors out there that are utilizing this technology that nobody ever thought would, you know, somebody pointed out, I think it was, Senator Reid that we want to make the good better and get rid of the bad. Well, this is bad stuff that's going on.
The crime is certainly bad, but I would note that, first of all, I wouldn't blame the technology, and I think it's actually a terrible technology to commit crimes because it creates a public ledger, on a public record of each transaction. And so law enforcement are able to analyze that, analyze the public chain and are able to, that's why they were able to get back the Colonial Pipeline ransomware.
Okay. First of all, I didn't thank you guys for your testimony. I appreciate it very, very much. I spent much more time with you, Ms. Belcher, than I was going to with Brito and Walsh, but hopefully you'll be able to come back again. This is an issue we need more information on so that we can make good decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Chester. Senator Warren from Massachusetts is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you and the ranking member for holding this hearing. So the cryptocurrency boosters argue that crypto is the yellow brick road to a faster, cheaper, and safer financial system that works for everyone, not just for the biggest banks. There is no question that our financial system needs change, big structural change. And we should be willing to consider how these new technologies can help consumers and our economy. But as the cryptocurrency market grows, it is also our responsibility to carefully examine these claims and promises about crypto's potential. Now, one of the advantages crypto advocates claim about Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is that they're, quote, decentralized. Our current system is dominated by a handful of big banks that are mostly free to jack up costs for consumers, to restrict access to financial products, and gobble up smaller competitors until the big guys become too big to fail. By contrast, advocates claim that cryptocurrencies and the blockchain technology that underlies them decentralize power and control, creating the possibility of a more democratic financial system. So, Professor Walsh, that sounds pretty good to me. Has your research shown that crypto is decentralized in this way?
So it's true that in cryptocurrencies, you don't have one single central party. So I guess technically you could say, yes, it's decentralized. It's more than one. But we have to remember that there are absolutely pockets of power within these systems, particularly the core software developers and the large miners who can absolutely exploit their position of power to affect users of the systems.
So they have the capacity here to manipulate the system. You know, that sounds to me like a lousy trade-off. Instead of leaving our system, our financial system, at the whims of giant banks, crypto puts the system at the whims of some shadowy, faceless group of super coders and miners, which doesn't sound better to me. So let me ask about another claim benefit of crypto, which is that it's safer and more secure than traditional government-issued money in the bank. Because the blockchain system is supposed to be difficult to hack, impossible to manipulate, and less prone to network failure, we might not need to worry about things like data breaches or a cyber attack that takes down the network. Professor Walsh, are cryptocurrencies as safe and secure as the proponents claim?
So they certainly have characteristics that enable them to be, you know, resistant to hacking, but it's a misnomer to say that anything is absolutely secure. The parties within the system, such as miners, can exploit their positions to reorganize the blockchain. In some circumstances, that's become a big issue and topic of discussion within Ethereum. And this leaves out even the fact that there have been countless hacks of exchanges and stuff that are outside the crypto systems.
Okay, thank you. But even if crypto isn't an improvement over our current system when it comes to being more democratic or less hackable, there's one other possible benefit, and it is a big one. Crypto proponents claim that crypto is safe from the kind of financial crisis that blew up the economy back in 2008. After all, the story goes, the motivation behind Bitcoin's creation was to avoid exposure to bank collapses and financial contagion in the traditional financial system. Professor Walsh, for that to be true, crypto would have to be insulated from the risks that make our financial system vulnerable to a crisis and vice versa. Is that the case?
No, I don't believe that is true. Risks in the crypto sector, software bugs, attacks, anything that could go wrong there can affect the entire crypto sector, but can also, through all these links that have been built between the crypto financial system and the traditional financial system, those risks can come across those bridges, those links, to affect people in the traditional financial system who may never have actually touched crypto in their lives.
All right. So look, there's no doubt that we need a stronger, safer, and more inclusive financial system. The biggest banks have too much power, present too many risks to financial stability, and have failed to serve Americans' needs. The giant banks have created huge problems, but I'm not convinced that crypto is the solution. In fact, crypto could be even more dangerous for consumers, more dangerous for the environment, and more dangerous for the stability of our financial system. That is why yesterday I sent a letter to Secretary Yellen in her capacity as head of the Financial Stability Oversight Council to urge her to lead our regulators in developing a comprehensive and coordinated approach to regulating cryptocurrencies. Look, all the warning signs are flashing. The hype, the volatility, the wild claims that turn out to be false. As the crypto market grows, so do the risks to our financial stability and our economy. Regulators need to do their job and step in before it's too late. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Warren, Senator Van Hollen from Maryland is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Toomey, and thank all of you for your testimony today. I've been a long proponent of getting the Federal Reserve to move quickly to implement the FedNow system, which is a real-time payment system that will eventually help millions of consumers avoid many costly overdraft and other fees that have cost them billions and billions of dollars. At the same time, we've heard that faster instant payments are often argued as one of the benefits of blockchain technology. And so my question, starting with Professor Walsh, is how do you evaluate these relative benefits and risks? And what are the pros and cons of seeing blockchain and crypto as a means to provide faster payments compared to other possibilities?
So I think one thing to keep in mind is that there have been policy decisions made to about the speed at which transactions should be settled on our large global settlement systems. And to my understanding, it's not technology issues that are controlling the speed. It's policy decisions about what is appropriate and what best manages the risks involved. As far as settlement issues on cryptocurrencies, they can be fast, but typically, because they are probabilistically settled, meaning you don't know for sure that the transaction is final because someone could theoretically come and reorganize the blockchain. They're very different, right? There's no moment of legal finality on a blockchain. You're probably never going to get your transaction changed.
Mr. Brito, could you just comment on that?
Sure. So I don't think that cryptocurrencies are going to necessarily competing with what FedNow is trying to do. They're sort of different things. I would say to what Professor Walsh just said, that they are fast. It is probabilistic, but we are building second layer networks on top of networks like Bitcoin that provide faster and more easily settled transactions, something like the Lightning Network. And what one of the things that these networks allow you to do that FedNow, I don't think, can allow you to do is to engage in microtransactions. So imagine being able to make payments that are pennies or sub-penny amounts. That's something that is not really economical using our existing financial infrastructure. And so once you can do that, that opens up a whole range of possibilities of innovations that can take advantage of that we can't even imagine. One thing that comes to mind is today the business model of the web is either advertising, which means tracking, or it is payment, but you can't just pay for the one article or the one song that you're listening to. You have to pay for a subscription. And so maybe you don't want that. Imagine a third option that can compete with the ad networks and the big gated content providers that allows people to pay per article, per second of streaming video. That's completely new. Imagine going to an airport and instead of buying paying $20 for a day pass to Wi-Fi, you can just pay for the 5 minutes that you need or the few kilobytes that you need. And at the same time, maybe you share the Wi-Fi in your home and you receive payments from people walking by the street that you can then use that crypto at the airport, right?
Got it. No, I appreciate that. I do want to follow up in my remaining time with some of the issues Senator Warren raised, because Professor Walsh, you have written about how software developers and cryptocurrency miners should be seen as fiduciaries. And you talked this morning about how those were sort of they're not centralized, but they're key choke points in the system and can be manipulated to harm consumers. Could you talk about a specific example of how a cryptocurrency miner might be able to take advantage of a cryptocurrency platform?
Sure. So in many of these proof of work systems like Bitcoin and Ethereum, there are large mining pools. And that means that the other computers who are involved in contributing their power to verify the transactions on the network, entrust that mining pool operator with the power to pick the transactions that are going to go on the ledger and the order in which they will appear. That role and ability to choose the transactions and add a new series of them to the list, to the ledger, rotates, right, around the different miners. So people say it's disintermediated, but during the moment when the miner is choosing the transactions for a particular block, technologists characterize this as being in God mode. Right. So those miners can sell their, price out how valuable it is to people to front run transactions. Right. To choose to put one transaction before or behind another. They can do that for their own benefit. And there are huge amounts. We need to get the research before Congress. There are huge amounts of value that miners are exploiting in this way right now. And it is seen as a critical issue to the success of cryptocurrencies and any claims that it has to be immutable, secure, or to lack intermediaries.
Thank you. And if the other witnesses want to provide for the record their opinion on this issue, I do think it's an important consumer protection question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Van Hollen. Senator Smith of Minnesota is recognized.
Thank you. Let's see. Can you? I'm having trouble. Oh, there we go. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ranking Member Toomey. Appreciate this hearing. Professor Walsh, in your prepared testimony, you briefly described decentralized finance or DeFi. And you said that DeFi is a set of financial products mirroring those in the traditional finance system that are rapidly being created. So over the last 100 years, Congress has enacted this regulatory framework for banking, securities, derivatives, and other key parts of our financial system. And those laws exist for a good reason, right? They are there to protect consumers and the integrity of our financial systems. And we wrote these laws based on, Congress wrote these laws based on lessons learned from stock offerings rife with insider trading and fraud in the 1930s, the boiler room schemes of the 1980s, the risky swaps and derivatives that blew up our economy in 2008. So it concerns me when I hear about a seemingly unregulated DeFi derivatives market springing up to operate side by side with this regulated derivatives market. Last month, CFTC Commissioner Dan Berkowitz said in a speech, and I'm quoting here, "Not only do I think that unlicensed DeFi market for derivative instruments are a bad idea, I also don't see how they are legal under the Commodities Exchange Act." So, Professor Walsh, do you agree that many of these DeFi instruments are probably operating in violation of the Commodities Exchange Act, or how do you see this?
So I have not analyzed that question particularly, but I see this as we need to look carefully within these systems and see where the same activities are happening and whether there are the same risks. And one of the claims that is made within, crypto systems is that a lot of these practices are fully automated by software. So therefore, there is not any particular person to be accountable. I think we need to press harder on those claims because there are people who are, you know, running the software, who have the keys to make changes to the software. There have been many bugs in these systems that have required the parties who have released the software to run these financial transactions. There have been bugs discovered, and they had to use their keys that they had failed to disclose that they had to fix the problem. So we need to look for where power exists, decide how that right. power compares to power in our existing financial system, and think about ways to address it.
Thank you for that. It seems to me that could be an argument for going down a path where there's virtually no accountability. If you argue that there's not a person here, it's just sort of this nameless technology, yet you still have what I'm so concerned about, which is this unregulated derivatives market operating side by side with a regulated derivatives market, and how that could reward rule breakers and then undermine the system of exchanges and dealers and clearinghouses that Congress has established through a century of experience, right?
Yeah, I think you need to look for the humans in the system, find them and ask what they're doing, and whether you think it poses a risk to other people.
Thank you. I want to touch on a different topic just in a few minutes that I have left. According to a recent estimate, Bitcoin mining produces about 37 megatons of carbon dioxide each year. So that's the same amount of emissions as the entire country of New Zealand. So if you take that on a per transaction basis, it's estimated that Bitcoin takes 500,000 times more energy to verify a payment compared with a Visa transaction. So that's a lot of energy, especially at a moment where we are, a crucial moment for addressing the need to take action on climate. If Bitcoin were just a little fad, then maybe that we could ignore this energy inefficiency. But now Bitcoin is estimated to consume 0.5% of all global electricity. Cryptocurrency is increasingly a real concern also as a driver of global emissions. And this clearly isn't sustainable. So I just have a couple of minutes. Would any members of our panel like to comment on this, and what needs to happen to keep cryptocurrencies from becoming such a significant contributor to climate change?
Thank you for that question, Senator. I would note that different cryptocurrencies have different proof systems that use different amounts of energy. And when we built the first computer, it was the size of an entire room. But over time, technology gets more scalable and sustainable. And we've also seen major cryptocurrencies switch over to less energy-intensive proof systems, such as Ethereum's recent move to proof of stake. And the energy here is being used to achieve particular societal benefits. So for Filecoin, those benefits are creating a decentralized storage network. as one example.
Thank you. I'm out of time, but this strikes me as a significant issue. We'll follow up, Mr. Brito, since I'm out of time. But I think this is a really important issue that we can't just say we'll ride that cost curve down when we don't have time to do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Toomey has one more comment or question.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman. I'll ask one question of Mr. Brito. I think Ms. Walsh has at least once, maybe a couple of times, alluded to the power of miners, and specifically the power of miners to decide which transactions get put into the block and when. And I think it's fair to say that the insinuation is that they may have motives and self-interest that might cause them to make decisions that would not necessarily be expected by the users, that they're nefarious, maybe too strong a word, but that there is a self-interest that might cause them to engage in some kind of distortion. So how should we think about the miners and their power to decide which transactions get put into the block and their whole role in the validation process?
Sure. So what we have to understand is that miners cannot redirect, steal, or initiate a user's payments. They can, however, affect the order that payments are confirmed on the blockchain during the periodic moments when they successfully mine the next block. So they can't block you from making a transaction that you want to make. They can just say in what order in the block are you located. Now, this is not a problem in the general case of a person sending money to another person. on the Bitcoin blockchain, for example, right? Has no effect whatsoever. It can be a problem in decentralized exchange transactions on something like Ethereum, when miners use their ability to order transactions to their advantage. The same problem exists in traditional financial markets. It's why high-speed traders build proprietary infrastructure to get their trades in as soon as possible. It's why this committee rightly discusses payment for order flow. So the problem is very similar. One advantage of decentralized finance is that the blockchain reveals these strategies publicly rather than happening secretly, right? Thanks to murky, you know, internal policies at a large financial institution. Speaking generally, to the extent that we believe that there is a lack of fairness in these trading systems, one of the best solutions is to implement alternative market mechanisms that reduce the advantages of transaction ordering, right? You can change the design of the exchange. And since the exchange designers don't want this to happen, don't want the miners to be doing this, the participants certainly don't want this, there's every incentive to exchange that exchange mechanism, right? Many economists now favor using frequent batch auctions rather than continuous order books for transactions in order to prevent these problems. And what's interesting is that if we were going to change from a continuous order book to frequent batch auctions at CME or the New York Stock Exchange, that would require one massive institutional change. With crypto, it's trivially easy for anybody to build a competing exchange that users will go to. And indeed, we've seen this, and we're beginning to see this. And also, the developers of the Ethereum network itself don't want to see this, and they are going to be addressing the problem as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Toomey. Thank you all. This is Senator Toomey and I were talking. This is one of the most illuminating hearings we've had, and I appreciate you all were persuasive, each in your own way, and thank you for that. We will, for senators who wish to submit questions for the record, those questions are due 1 week from today, Tuesday, August 3rd, to the witnesses. Each of you have 45 days to respond to any questions. Thank you again. The hearing is adjourned.